Welcome to Night 22 of the 1001 Nights podcast. Each episode, we bring you the ancient mythology of the Arabian Nights as reinterpreted by modern authors. This week, we feature the tale of the Sultan Steward by Mac Barnett. We bring you this story in its entirety. The stories of the 1001 Nights are famously told by Scheherazade in a heroic effort to forestall her execution and save her people. Last night, Scheherazade began the story of the Humpback, a winding tale of coincidences in which multiple parties believe that they are responsible for killing a humpbacked man, who, in reality, choked on a fishbone. All supposedly guilty parties come before a sultan and are asked each to tell a story that's more wonderful and strange and exciting than the story of the humpback's many deaths. First, the Christian broker stood before the sultan and told his tale. Then, the sultan's own steward stepped forward claiming that he had a story more curious than that of the humpback's. We find Scheherazade in bed with her own murderous sultan. It is very late into the night, and the sultan is unable to sleep, the weight of the past pressing down on him heavily in the darkness. Scheherazade gently rolls over to face him.
Would you like to hear another story, my love?
The sultan nods, his eyes fixed on the ceiling, and so Scheherazade begins to tell her tale.
Now, sir, here's a tale both wonderful and strange, and although I did not myself bear witness to the events I will relate, I do testify to their veracity. I saw the man's body, and I swear to you his injuries are real. As to the manner by which this sorry fellow came to be disfigured, I can only say this. I was born with a careful ear, and since childhood have been able to divine when a man is feeding me the truth. This story was told to me by an honest fellow. It's rare enough to meet an honest stranger in the desert. An honest stranger with a good story is rarer still. The stranger rode up upon our camp coming west at dusk. It was the second month of our drive, and we were tired of each other's company. The stranger was a man of good humor, and we entreated him to eat with us that night. It is remarkable what life a new face can bring to a tired outfit. With the stranger listening, our tired jokes once again became funny, and he listened with relish to stories that we'd worn out weeks before. The top hand was a man named Soames, who was good on guitar, and the man had a wonderful voice that he changed to suit the song, whether sweet or body. Much later events would befall our outfit that led me to believe the drive was cursed. But you could not say we ever ate poorly. Our cook was a man of particular talents. That night we supped on rabbit stew, and when we had drained our bowls, we were presented a skillet full of golden cornbread. The cook would then finish a jug of molasses, one of six he kept in the wagon for special occasions, and laying the skillet before our guest, he smiled proudly as he poured generously from the jug. We hands let forth with oohing and aahing, which we knew delighted the cook, who took pride in his abilities. But upon witnessing the trickle of molasses, our guest sat ashen and afraid, shaking his head as though accused by some hairy phantom of his conscience. The stranger entreated the cook to remove the jug from his sight, asking why we would mock him. It took no small amount of reassurance to convince the stranger that the molasses had been provided in his honor. Perhaps not wanting to further offend our scowling cook, the stranger resumed somewhat his genteel manner and declared that the cornbread looked delicious, and he would be delighted to share in it if only he could wash his hands. I fetched a basin and some soap and laid them down before the stranger. He set to washing his hands full 40 times, counting to himself each time he rinsed them before picking up the soap again, so that I became worried the lye would peel his flesh. Our group was dumbstruck by this queer act of hygiene. It was only when he finished and raised a morsel of cornbread to his mouth that we first noticed the stranger had only 4 fingers on his hand. Wanting for conversation in that awful silence, one of our number inquired about the missing thumb. The stranger smiled. "It's not just the thumb of my right hand gone," he said, "but also the left." And removing his boots, the man showed us that the first toe on either foot had been severed off as well. How could this have happened? We all wondered. I relate now his story in his own words, as best as I remember. My father was a gambler first, a drunk second, and a shopkeeper last of all. When he died, he left me many debts, and a few wares in a dry goods store off the main street. I set to trading and managed to hold off my creditors, and spent that first summer on the precipice between profit and ruin. One Saturday in September, an old man came leading a mule down the alley where I kept my shop. Peering through a grimy window, I was able to make out the figure of a young woman astride the animal. Fine embroidery covered her dress, and she wore a veil over her face. The old man was nervous, and he kept glancing up and down the street like he was looking for an ambush. He exchanged some hot words with the woman on the mule, and although I could not hear their argument, it was clear the woman won. The man sighed and led the mule on down the street. It was early, and my shop was the only one open. Before long, I heard the tinkling of the bell on my front door. I hurried outside and entered the room to find the woman removing her veil. What I saw astonished me. She smiled, and I was transfixed. Gentlemen, she was like the moon. I startled myself by falling in love on the spot. The old man did the talking for the woman, and by denying my ears the pleasure of her voice, he earned my instantaneous hatred. He told me the lady was looking for Chinese silks, and did I have any? I replied, looking straight at the woman, and I swear to you, she smiled slightly in her eyes when I did so, that I did not have any in my shop, but that if she would wait here, I would go round and collect some for her perusal. This appeared to please the woman and relieve the old man, so I fetched them chairs and coffee and hurried out to hammer my fists on the doors of every shop in town. I returned shortly with an armful not just of scarves, but of several dresses from San Francisco and some jewelry besides. The lady was pleased, and she complimented my eye. I blushed and she blushed, and I swear to you that in my life I had never been so happy. She then astounded me by saying she would take everything in front of her. The old man helped me load up the mule, and when we were finished, I stood there and I watched her ride away. I kept standing there even after she was gone. It was only then I realized I had not asked her where she lived, and with her owing near $500 to me for the merchandise. Still, from the promissory note written in her own hand, I learned the young woman's name, Apollina. I pressed the paper to my breast. Weeks passed and I heard nothing. The shopkeepers were daily at my door demanding payment for the woman's goods and me unable to pay. My friends became my enemies. I was a broken man and I made preparations to put all I owned on the auction block. Every night I cursed my heart for leading me like a beast towards destitution. My father, the drunkard, managed his business for 4 decades. And here, not a year in business, and I had been ruined by a swindler, a confidence artist in lace petticoats. On the 4th week, the old man came pulling the mule down the alley and Apollina in the saddle. He hitched the animal outside my shop, and she daintily dismounted. She was veiled again and did not remove the covering from her face until she was safely in my shop. She smiled and remarked that it had been too long since she'd seen my last, and hoped the time had passed well for me. I swear to you, I could feel my heart swell up in my ribs. She bade the old man pay me, and he fetched from the mule a large purse, from which he drew the money owed plus $50 extra as gratitude for my patience. Patience! And ere I had spent the month chewing my thumbnails down to nubs while I paced the shop. It took what manly resolve I had left in me to keep from throwing myself at her feet to weep. Silently, I thanked God for my salvation. Not just for my station, but my heart had been restored by her visit. I poured coffee for the three of us, and we sat and talked. If I could summon a genie and demand three wishes, as in those old stories, I would have spent all three wishing the old man away. How I longed for just a moment alone with my Apollina. Still, I wondered if the old man would be turned to my cause, and when they prepared to leave, obscured behind the animal's flank, I asked him sotto voce if he might serve as a go-between between myself and his mistress, delivering letters and helping me win her love. "You fool," said the old man. "She loves you already. Did you see the way she looks at you? You've been on her tongue since we last came to town." I could not believe my fortune. "So then, old man, shall I ask her father for her hand?" The old man leered. "Her father? I shouldn't if I were you. She is the adopted daughter of the judge, who so wanted a child even after his wife died. He loves her fierce, and has not let her leave the house for fear that she could take up with some low salesman as yourself. He'd sooner shoot you than see you wed his daughter." I cried out, but the old man silenced me. "Hush, boy," he said. "Do you think she would have come here without a plan? Why do you think we have been so long in returning?" At some point, Apollina made her way to our side of the mule, and must have been listening to the conversation, for now she spoke up behind me. "Do you have a barrel?" she asked. "Of course I did." "If you love me as I love you," said my Apollina, "at midnight you will place the barrel outside your door and secret yourself inside." I was in love and did not ask questions, but that day repaid the merchants for Apollina's wares, and that night climbed into a beer barrel I'd left on my stoop. How long did I wait? An hour? Three? Before I heard the familiar clip-clop of my lady's mule. I tell you, I was elated. I heard the voices of two men, one of whom I recognized as the old man, and soon I was roughly lifted and strapped to the mule. It was an awful ride, and I was worried about the bumps and bruises I would show when I stood before my love. I found myself wishing I had the forethought to stuff a pillow or an eiderdown quilt in the bear with me to safely cocoon myself. My only comfort was the image of Apollina's face I'd inscribed in my brain. It must have been near dawn when we arrived at the judge's house, for the songbirds had been at it quite a while. I was unloaded and carried for a stretch, and then set down roughly on the hard floor. There was whispering and some commotion, and soon I heard the strong voice of the judge. The judge had earned a reputation as a violent man and a bully. He was also widely known to be an early riser, which was the cause of my current predicament. I quavered a bit in my hiding place when I heard him grumbling nearby. "And what is that?" the judge asked. I knew he was talking of my barrel.
"A keg of beer from Dunbar's," said the old man in a cool voice that earned him my admiration.
"Dunbar's?" said the judge. "Well, tap it, Bradley, and give me a taste. Dunbar is a cheat, and I will not pay again for spoiled beer."
"But just last night we tapped a new keg," said the old man. "Tap this one a day, and it will set to spoiling. Surely we should wait, and if we discover later upon tapping this keg that the beer is spoiled, Dunbar will replace it."
"Bradley, you will tap this keg now, or I shall set upon you."
And he began banging his great fists on the top of my barrel, jolting my bones and splitting my ears. I'm not embarrassed to admit that at this moment I became so frightened for my life, I pissed myself.
"Look, father," came a woman's voice.
"My Apollina,
you have split the staves with all your hammering, and now the beer is leaking out on the floor."
damn it!" shouted the judge, along with several other oaths. "Bradley, fix this!" And with that, the bail was removed to another room, and with me in it. Shortly, the old man fetched a crowbar and freed me from my confinement, and led me to my love's chambers in the judge's big house. It was a room filled with scarlet curtains and paintings of Greeks lazing near rivers. A slender, red-cheeked servant provided me with a wash basin and a suit of white linen. I thanked her, and she blushed. That night, I was married to my Apollina. The old man performed the rites, and the slender servant girl was our witness and presented us our wedding cup to drink of. It was never how I imagined my betrothal, but I would not have had a different ceremony. The girl laid out our wedding feast, wine and pheasant ham, and upon my request, a dozen deviled eggs. For dessert, there were cakes, drizzled with molasses. The sweets were delicious, but by that time I was eager to repair to our wedding bed, and so I wiped my hands upon my trousers and led my bride to her sleeping chambers. Her body lay bare and pale before me in the moonlight. I trembled as I touched her. But no sooner had I laid my hands upon her breast than she leapt out of bed and began to wave her finger at me. "Are you mad?" she cried. "Have you lost your wits?" "My love," I said, "what have I done wrong?" "You madman!" She summoned the red-cheeked servant and bade her fetch a whip. With that, she set upon my arms and back. "Oh," I cried, "stop, my bride, or I shall soon be murdered. Tell me, please, what have I done?" "Madman," said Apollina, "how dare you touch my body with molasses on your hands? Do you mean to defile me? Would you leave my body sticky on our wedding night? By God, I will cut off the filthy hand you laid upon me." I was at a loss. She covered herself and called for the old man. I'm afraid the wine had done its work, and he had no trouble biting my arms and tying me to the bed. The old man produced a hatchet, and my Apollina stood over me. I asked for whiskey, which the old man poured down my throat. The servant girl was now crying. She begged her mistress to spare my hand. "If not his hand, I must take something," she said. "His thumbs," said the old man, sneering, "and his big toes." "That makes four," said my bride. "I'll need a fifth." And in her eye, I saw the same gleam I'd seen in men who make a lewd joke. "No," I said, and the servant girl moved to hold her back. But my love shook free and stood before me. I heard myself shriek, and all went black. I woke up the man you now see in the light of your campfire. We sat and watched him pick up another piece of cornbread and raise his fingers to his mouth. I drew a sheepskin around myself and shivered. "Did you ever lie with her?" asked Soames. Several among us groaned, and the cook threw a rock at Soames, but in truth, he'd asked something we all wanted to know. "We lived together 5 years as husband and wife. The judge died a month ago, whereupon my Apollo came to me and told me I must leave the house. I thought I had misheard. 'You mean we must leave?' I said. 'We are man and wife.' She laughed. 'Nobody knows we're married. Bradley died years ago, and my servant will say nothing. I am a woman of means now, and you encumber me.' I confess that I broke into tears and begged her to let me prove my love. I'm proud to say she assented. So strong is the bond of two hearts truly entwined. She entrusted me with a trunk full of gold bars and bade me ride west and make a home for us in California. When our house is built, I'm to write her, and she will come and join me." The stranger beamed and began to wash his hands again. A terrible silence settled over our company. I did not like to think of the chances that woman was waiting for his letter, nor his chances of making it across the desert with a trunk full of gold. We listened to him count each time he rinsed his hands in the basin. 20, then 30, then 40. I cannot say what was in the minds of those other men around the fire. and I do not want to tell you what was in mine.
Tonight's story, the story told by the Sultan's steward, was retold by Mac Barnett. Mac is a New York Times bestselling author of over 18 books for children, including two Caldecott Honor-winning collaborations with John Klassen, Sam and Dave Dig a Hole and Extra Yarn, which also won the Boston Globe Hornbook Award and the E.B. White Read Aloud Award. He writes the Brixton Brothers series of mystery novels, and with Jory John, The Terrible Two. He lives in beautiful, sunny Berkeley, California. The 1001 Nights podcast is produced by Nathan Kane and me, Morgan Dubin. Scheherazade is voiced by the beautiful and talented Ariel Siegel. The music on the 1001 Nights podcast is generously contributed by Havan Laura Lemmy, Pharaoh's Daughter, and Eric Hopton. I am a huge fan of Mac Barnett and his children's books. When he told me he would contribute to this podcast,
I swear to you, I could feel my heart swell up in my ribs.
That's it. I'm not nearly as funny as Nathan. You can learn more about the 1001 Nights podcast by visiting www.1001nightspodcast.com. Thank you and good morning.